I am here with Michael Osterholm. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So you have written an alarming book titled The Big One, How We Must Prepare for Future Deadly Pandemics. You co-wrote that with Mark Olshaker. And we're going to get into that. I mean, obviously, we're as a presage to your book. I mean, your book accomplishes much of this as well. I think we should do a bit of a post-mortem on the COVID pandemic and what we've learned or failed to learn from that experience. That was as bad as that was a kind of dress rehearsal for the thing you're imagining, which would be quite a bit worse. Before we jump in, what is your scientific background and what are your responsibilities as an epidemiologist at this point?
Well, I actually was fortunate enough to know when I was in seventh grade, I wanted to become a medical detective. It turned out that someone in my small Iowa farm town actually subscribed to The New Yorker. And at that time, there were a series of articles in there by Burt and Roget, which were medical whodunits, basically kind of the CDC versions of these outbreaks. And when I read that, I said, this is what I want to do. So when I graduated from undergraduate, I immediately went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota in infectious disease epidemiology, and at the same time was employed by the Minnesota Department of Health. And so I've now been in the business 50 years, of which 25 of those years were split between the university and the state health department, and then 25 I've just been at the university. Throughout that time, I also have had a number of other appointments. And I think for the context of our comments today, I've had a role in every presidential administration since Ronald Reagan, having been involved with HIV/AIDS back in the 1980s. And during Trump 1, I was a science envoy for the State Department, going around the world trying to help get us better prepared for a pandemic. That was in 2017-18. Not sure we did so well that way. And then, of course, I was on the Biden-Harris transition team. So I'm an epidemiologist by training. Our group has been involved with many, many outbreaks of international importance. And then at the university, I started the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy in 2001, the same week as 9/11. And we had already been very involved in the area of bioterrorism. In fact, I wrote a book that was published on September 1st of 2000 that was called Living Terrors, What Our Country Needs in Order to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe. And right after, of course, 9/11, my book, which I think I had bought 14 of the 18 copies that were sold in the year between its publication and 9/11, and then became a New York Times bestseller. I ended up splitting my time between Minnesota and the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington as an advisor to then Secretary Tommy Thompson. So I was very involved in those international activities and have really had a variety of experiences, but I've published a lot, even early on the issue of the potential for pandemics. 2017, I published the book, Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs. And I laid out in three chapters what a serious pandemic would look like, which I had suggested it was an influenza virus. It was obviously a coronavirus, but if you read the three chapters, you would think it was exactly what had happened throughout the course. So I continue to be obviously very engrossed in the issue of pandemic preparedness, but it comes from a lifetime of experience with infectious diseases.
Well, as you know, management has changed over at the HHS since you were there. I think we'll probably get a chance to comment on that. But let's talk about your experience during COVID. Many of us, I think, first discovered you on Joe Rogan's podcast. You appeared fairly early in the pandemic. And I must say, we found yourself talking to a very different Joe Rogan than the Joe Rogan that we have with us now on these topics. What was your experience of trying to message into a very fragmented and fragmenting information landscape during the first months and maybe perhaps first year of COVID?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we picked up on this situation in Wuhan actually on December 30th of 2019. So we were well aware of what was going on at that time. And of course, we didn't have an infectious agent at the point. But then soon after, we realized it wasn't influenza virus. And I thought, well, this is great. We can probably control this because I'd been very involved with both SARS and MERS, two other coronavirus infections that had occurred in 2003. SARS, a severe acute respiratory syndrome disease that came out of China, was one that, because I was still at the Department of Health and Human Services, I helped respond at a national level. And what we found was a virus that was not that infectious, except for a few super spreaders, but enough so that we could really control it. But it killed anywhere up to 15% of the people. And then in 2012, we had another coronavirus emerge on the Arabian Peninsula, MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, a virus that originated from camels. Mm-hmm. And very much the same picture as we saw with SARS, in the sense that it wasn't that infectious, we could really control it. But the difference was 35% of the people who developed MERS died from it. And so that was surely a warning. And in my book in 2017, when I laid out the three chapters that talked about pandemics, one of the chapters after that was that coronavirus is a harbinger of things to come. And so I kind of sensed that we could see a very different world. Well, along comes MERS and following SARS, giving us a sense of what could be really bad. But then, of course, we saw COVID arrive, and it was highly, highly infectious, unlike the other two, but it was not killing nearly as many, 1.5% of the people, which still is a very real and large number. And so at that point, when early in the pandemic, I thought if this was a coronavirus, this is good news. We're going to be able to control it, mm-hmm. like we did SARS and MERS. Well, that went out the window quickly when we recognized that there was clearly a lot of airborne aerosol-based transmission occurring, people not even knowing they were infectious, infecting people at long distances away from them. And on January 20th of 2020, I actually wrote a piece on our website and said, this is the next pandemic, get on with it. And that was not well received by many. They didn't want to believe that such a thing was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you noted about the issue with Joe Rogan. Actually, on March 10th of 2020, I was on Rogan. And at that time, I made a prediction that I thought we could easily see 800,000 deaths in the next 18 months in this country. And I might as well have said bad things about everybody's mother, because that too was not well received. And of course, you know what happened. In fact, 18 months later, we were at 790,000 deaths.
Yeah.
And so I think that was the hard part, was getting people early on to recognize we really were in the face of this. And it wasn't until middle March before the WHO actually declared it a pandemic.
What was the resistance to acknowledging the airborne contagiousness of COVID? This is something you talk about in your book a bit. It seemed that we were very slow to admit this. And even as we were starting to admit it, there was this emphasis on droplet spread as opposed to aerosol spread, which perhaps you can take a moment to describe the difference, but it's a very important difference from an epidemiological point of view.
Well, I hate to admit this, but we still have a challenge today. There's still a core group of people that don't believe that it's airborne. What we mean by airborne and droplet-related transmission is, how does the virus leave your body such that it would expose others to the virus? And in the case of a respiratory infection in your lungs, in your nasal passages that then you breathe out, basically when I talk or you talk, and when we cough, we have these large droplets that actually come out of our mouth, our nose, that if you're in the front two rows of a concert or a play, you can see the actor or singer, and you see these drops constantly coming out. Hmm. Well, they fall to the ground, usually within 6 to 8 feet. And so you could be in the same room with someone 20 feet away and never really be exposed if it's a droplet. And there are some diseases that are primarily droplet transmitted. However, an aerosol is that fine, fine material that's coming out of my mouth as I speak right now. And if you could test this room, you'd find my aerosol has actually infiltrated much of the room. And you'd have no idea that it's there. To give you an idea what an aerosol is like, think of walking outside and suddenly you smell cigarette smoke and 30 feet upwind from you is somebody smoking. That's an aerosol. That's right. What floats. If you're in your house and a light comes shining through the window and you see all those particles floating in the air, that's an aerosol. They sit there. And that's what is so challenging, because they can move great distances. And in fact, one of the classic outbreaks in an airborne related mode was happened right here in Minneapolis, not far from where I am right now, at the Hubert Humphrey Metrodome, back when we had the Special Olympics here for the world. And on the opening night ceremony, all of the participants, coaches, players, et cetera, marched in from the right field kind of garage door, we call it, filled the infield and outfield. Well, meanwhile, there were 64,000 people in the stands. We had not had measles in this state for almost five years. Well, after that night, when a young boy from Argentina who stood almost on home plate was breaking with measles, there was an outbreak that subsequently occurred over the next 10 days to 2 weeks with the players, coaches, et cetera. But in that opening night session, there was also an outbreak of people who had never had any other association with the Special Olympics except being at the opening night session. And we had not, as I said, had indigenous measles in the state, so we figured that this had to be involved. When we actually placed where these people sat that night, they all sat in the very small same section of the stadium at 400 and almost 90 feet away from the home plate, and where they're near an outtake fan was located in the stadium. And it turned out that the air was coming out behind home plate, passing this young boy, and then literally traveled through the air to that outtake fan at the time where Mark McGwire on steroids couldn't hit a home run. And it basically infected everybody in that section who hadn't previously had measles or who had not been vaccinated. And so it just shows you how dynamic this virus can be in its movement. And that's measles, but measles and COVID viruses are very similar in how they're transmitted.
So you make the point that if the barrier you have put up or the precautions you have made would not prevent you smelling someone smoking a cigarette on the other side of those barriers or precautions, it's not going to prevent the transmission of an aerosol-based respiratory virus.
You know, we engage in so much hygiene theater where people wanted to feel safe. They wanted to say, if you stay 6 feet away from me, it'll be okay. We spent millions and millions of dollars on plexiglass shields that were supposed to protect people. They provided no protection whatsoever. And I think that's a lesson that really needs to be brought forward for future pandemics. We need much better respiratory protection. We need better air quality. You know, when you and I drink water out of a tap or eat, in most cases, our food, we assume it's pretty much safe, but we never think about the air. And in fact, that's one of the real challenges right now is for the future, how do we help protect people trying to stay, you know, in line with their everyday life, but at the same time, keeping them from getting infected? And one way to do that would be have a much more effective type of respiratory protection mask. The one we have now is called an N95. Basically, it's one where if you think about where does a mask leak, it never leaks in the material as such, just like a swim goggles don't leak in the lens, they leak in the seal. N95s are meant to be really tight to the face. The problem with that is if you have something that's too occlusive, meaning it's blocking air, you suffocate. So what is unique about these N95 respirators is it's a material that's made to have enough porous space for air to move readily through it, but they have an electrostatic charge built into it, so it traps all the virus if I'm breathing it out or if I'm inhaling it in. And unfortunately, those type of respirators, as we call them, are really somewhat uncomfortable to wear for long periods of time. We should have been investing during and after the pandemic in coming up with much better respiratory protection to deal with this airborne transmission issue.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about what we would want to prepare ourselves for the next pandemic, again, that could be quite a bit worse from COVID. I mean, one of the things we're dealing with here, I think, is a kind of a background of fundamental skepticism about this topic, because it's been widely perceived that in some ways we overreacted to COVID, right? I mean, and we implemented things that were, just dogmatically asserted to be true, which in retrospect weren't. There was a lot of confusion around what we knew and when we knew it. You know, COVID was a moving target, and the scientific messaging around that movement was often inept. Half of our society seems to imagine that the COVID vaccines were more dangerous than COVID itself. I believe we have someone running the HHS, RFK Jr., who is a fabulist and confabulator and liar and loon to a degree that it's a little hard to exaggerate, who is one of these people. I think he seems to believe that the vaccines were in fact more dangerous than the illness. And we may talk about the implications of that, but there's a lot of confusion here. So to be clear, I think we should say whatever we want to say about the lessons learned or not from COVID. But in talking about what you call the big one, we are talking about something that is unambiguously awful, where the mortality rate is, you know, an order of magnitude or worse than the mortality rate of COVID. And this will be something where the bodies will in fact be stacking up on in the streets, and it'll be completely unambiguous as to whether this is a lethal pathogen that we need to worry about. And so the first thing you have just put forward as something we really should have in hand and don't is a mask that is much easier to wear, a much more comfortable to wear, perhaps one that's washable, one that people will not hesitate to wear if they needed it, and that it's at least as good as an N95 that we have today. And
yeah.
So who's building that? I don't know, but somebody should get to work on that, given what we're about to say.
You know, to add context to this, because I appreciate very much how you just laid it out. I think you were very accurate in what you had to say. But, you know, I have experienced throughout my entire career kind of bad news, Mike, momentum. You know, I wrote the book on bioterrorism and what anthrax could do. It ended up doing it. In 2017, when I wrote about what a pandemic could look like, that's what COVID actually became. In each of those instances, before the events happened, everybody just said, you're just a scary guy. Well, let me just be really clear about this idea of what could be the big one. And in fact, I mentioned earlier that the coronaviruses that we have identified causing serious illness in humans, SARS, MERS, and COVID, basically what has fortunately kept those apart from their worst details are literally just something that's a temporary basis. What I mean by that is that COVID could very well have been much more seriously causing illness, but it didn't. It was 1.5% deaths. Well, it turns out that right now we've identified new coronaviruses in the wild, in animals, that have the infectiousness of what COVID was, but it has on board also the genetic packages that could kill, like MERS and SARS. So, I earlier said, you know, we've documented MERS killed 35% of the people it infected. You know, so the idea of what I'm putting forward is even if it's 7 or 10% case fatality rate, the percent of people who get sick and die, is still a lot less than what MERS could present to us if it was highly infectious. So I think people cannot deny that this is, in fact, truly a possibility. And the fact that we've actually identified this virus in nature is really important.
Remind me, is MERS more like 30% fatal?
30-35%.
Yeah.
Yep. And again, I worked on that extensively. I was an advisor of the royal family, the United Arab Emirates, and I was actually on the Arabian Peninsula working on that. Mm. And then in 2015, when an individual who had been to the Middle East came back home to Seoul, Korea, they came home with MERS, not realizing that they were hospitalized in Seoul and created several hospital-based outbreaks where they had been seen and, again, had that very high case fatality rate. I was in Seoul helping with that outbreak investigation. So I've seen SARS and MERS up close, and I can tell you under no conditions would I want to see either one of them develop the ability to be transmitted like COVID.
So, perhaps we should linger on the controversy around the origins of COVID. As far as I know, the jury is still out, and it would be rational to consider a lab leak origin and a wet market origin as something on the order of a coin toss. I mean, I know people are biased in one direction or the other, but neither thesis is crazy. Is that still the state of our understanding?
Yeah, and let me add context to that. You know, I was on the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, the newly appointed committee in 2005 that was supposed to oversee national research at the federal government level and in other labs around the country for reasons of safety. And so, you know, I was very involved with that. In 2012, I actually was one of several people on the NSAVB that raised real concerns about how some of the flu research was being conducted. So if anything, many people would call me a hawk on lab safety and the challenges about transmission. Having said that, I am completely on board with what you just said. We're never going to know. It's a coin toss. Was it a lab leak? Was it a spillover from nature? And my whole point is get over it and move on. Because what we're not doing is getting prepared for the future, which could, again, be either one, a lab leak or a potential spillover. And so I think, you know, as long as we keep fixated on that question, which we'll never have an answer that will provide us any comfort as to knowing what happened, we need to prepare for the future.
So in hindsight, what would you say we did wrong during COVID? What were the most, if you could just take the top three mistakes and not make them, what would you change about our response to the pandemic?
Well, all three of the examples I'm going to give you really come back to humility and communication, okay? Mm. Let me take the first one. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post in early March of 2020 saying, don't do lockdowns. They'll never work because of the fact we were talking about something that was likely to last up 2 to 3 years. Yeah. And could we really lock down for that long of a time period? And the answer was absolutely no.
What about slow the curve? That wasn't...
Well, that's where I'm going to come next.
Okay.
And so what I'd proposed is we use a concept of snow days. And what that was all about was the idea that at that early part of the pandemic, we had no vaccines, we had limited drug availability, but what was the one thing we could do to keep people from dying is providing them good supportive medical care. And if your hospital is at 140% census where people are in the hallways and beds in parking garages, you are getting bad care and a lot of people are going to die. And so my whole purpose here was to say, you know, what method would help us here reduce that? Well, let people know what the hospital census is every day. You know, make it your hospital has a public number, you can go look it up. And if we got to 90, 95%, we would ask people to voluntarily back off of public events, of maybe even schools, et cetera. And then when that number came back down, then you could begin to resume these activities. Mm-hmm. And again, we'd keep doing that day after day. That would have given us both a public awareness of what was happening and the fact that our really most important job was to keep the hospitals from being overrun.
Michael, sorry to interrupt, but isn't this epiphany contingent upon understanding that it's an airborne illness? And there was a moment there where we were, you know, wiping down our packages because we were worried about fomites. So at what point was it absolutely obvious that we were, at least to those who are willing to admit it, you know, that this was the worst case scenario with respect to infectiousness? At what point was it obvious that this was airborne and aerosol, and that you were not going you're not going to lock down so successfully so as to prevent its spread?
Yeah, there was a group of us early on that published information on this issue, clearly demonstrating this was airborne. Mm. So this was as early as February and March. And we were very critical at that time of the WHO and to some degree parts of the CDC, because they were not on board with this, even though there was a very significant data supporting it. So that did happen. But I think, again, coming back to why people stayed apart, whether it was airborne or whether it was droplet particles, they still did. And so one of the things I think there's a lot of revision of history going on right now with COVID. And one of those was lockdowns. And it turns out that in March of 2020, 41 states initiated some kind of what they called lockdowns. Now, you have to understand, I don't know what a lockdown really is when you think about all the different things that were tried, but take the state of Minnesota. We technically went into a lockdown in March of 2020. Our governor issued a directive order basically telling all non-essential workers basically to stay home. The problem was 82% of our workforce was deemed as essential workers. Mm. Now, that wasn't a lockdown. And even with that, by early June, all but one of the 41 states had eliminated those lockdowns. So people keep talking about lockdowns that lasted for months and months up to several years. That was not the case.
Right.
There were surely localized activities where people canceled events, schools were decided, but it wasn't based on a national federal level. And I think the challenge we had was people just were fearful of being in public places. And particularly as some of these waves of the virus continued to greatly see increased cases. And so I think the challenge we have was with lockdowns was they were mischaracterized what happened. Imagine if we had done snow days over a course of 6 to 12 months before vaccines arrived. I think people would have been much more compliant than just feeling like I'm locked up, now I'm not.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So what other mistakes come to mind when you look back?
Number two, I think, was with the vaccine. And this is a remarkable effort, this vaccine. I know some will be critical of it, but mRNA technology was in the works for at least 15 years before the pandemic. There was lots of good research information supporting how and why it could be used for COVID. And then it was done. And frankly, to have a vaccine within a year of this pandemic, I think was an absolute scientific miracle. Well, having said that, we also know that coronaviruses in general, when you get infected with the seasonal ones, the milder ones, or the more severe ones, you have what we call waning immunity, that over time, your protection from having been previously infected or vaccinated begins to be greatly reduced. when we first put out the results of the vaccine trials of 94 to 96% protection, that was remarkable, but it was only for 2 months.
Mm.
And one of the things some of us suggested was we should every month follow this cohort of people who are vaccinated and see what happened. And if it goes from 94 to 88 to 76 to 62% each month, we should tell the public that. And then we should tell them, guess what? Just like with flu, we're going to need to get a booster. If people had heard that, I think they would have reacted very differently than when they reacted when they thought that they had completely protected themselves with the 2 doses of vaccine.
Mm.
And no longer do they have to worry about it suddenly being told, oh, put your mask back on. You're getting ill. I think that left people with the idea that they'd been misled.
Yeah, also the claim that it would block transmission. I think these words came out of Biden's mouth at one point, that if you get the vaccine, you won't spread it to anybody. And I mean, in real time and certainly in retrospect, all of those misstatements were viewed in the most sinister possible light by critics of the vaccine and people who are given to, you know, conspiracy theories about everything high and low. And so those were malicious lies rather than just being misstatements or moments of scientific error that are then later corrected. And there's something about it, just that a public misunderstanding about how science progresses, which I think is at work here, but also just a disposition to see every misstatement as just the machinations of pure evil.
You know, and I think one of the misconceptions about science is that science is truth. Science is not truth. Science is the pursuit of truth. And we learn all the time, and we get better, and we get better, and we get better. I think our challenge is, when we're learning, we need to also be conveying that we're learning and that we'll keep them posted.
Right.
You know, we'll let you know what's going on. And so, you know, you may not like it when you read your retirement statement each day online, okay, to see where the money is, but at least you know what it looks like, okay? It's not somehow you find out once a year what your retirement fund looks like. And I think that one of the challenges that people had is they wanted more information and we didn't give it to them. If we had, I think that would have been really important. The last, you asked me for 3 points. The other one, actually, I believe, really focuses on the issue of border closings. You know, we have this fixation that somehow, once something happens somewhere in the world, when it's an infectious disease, we basically can keep it out. We have that ability. And think about what happened with COVID. It shows up in China. So what's our obvious port that we're worried about? The West Coast, okay? And somehow we're going to fortify that and keep it out. Meanwhile, the virus quickly goes to Europe via China to Europe, and then quickly from Europe to the East Coast, particularly New York City. And suddenly we're finding ourselves fighting COVID on the East Coast while we got this fortified West Coast. And the bottom line message is when you have one of these two viruses, either a coronavirus or a flu virus, they are what I call virus with wings. And in the scenario part of the book, where we actually each chapter build on a scenario, we point out early on, once a virus gets into humans, how quickly it travels around the world before you even know it's there. And border closings do nothing to actually really keep the virus out. And more importantly, what they do is they make countries reluctant to report what's going on in their country because they're fearful of what the reactions will be. So, you know, I really hope that for the future, we don't employ border closings because they will not accomplish better protection. And all they do is hinder the ability to get good information on what's happening around the world.
But this is in the case of something highly infectious and aerosolized like a flu or one of these coronaviruses like COVID or, you know, measles or something that's...
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily say the same for something that is harder to transmit. I mean, take something like Ebola, right? If there's a major outbreak of Ebola somewhere, is there an argument to be made that, you know, no one from that country should be able to cross a border?
Well, you know, to go back to the 2014 to 2016 outbreak of Ebola that occurred in West Central Africa, which was dramatic in the tens of thousands of people that were infected.
Mm.
And we did have a case here in the United States of someone that came in. But again, there was an additional spread in a sense of beyond, you know, we had 2 healthcare workers got infected, but we didn't see community spread. And so those viruses that, you know, you might say will keep everybody out from a certain country really are unnecessary because we can control it. And again, the last thing we want to do is have a country like Sierra Leone or Liberia not report to us what's going on. And so I even say there, I don't think border closings offer us any additional public health benefit. All they do is basically make it harder to track what's going on around the world.
Well, so that's interesting. So there's really no characteristic of a pathogen, whether viral or bacterial. And we'll talk about why bacteria are a lesser concern here in a minute. But there's no way something could spread, and there's no level of lethality where you would find yourself recommending border closures or, you know, Chinese-style quarantines, e.g. lockdowns.
Yeah. You know, again, it would be easy to say yes. That way you don't get caught in controversy as such. But I have to be true to the science of public health and say there is no real inherent benefit to locking down borders. Hmm. And whether it's a respiratory illness like this or whether, in fact, it's something spread by blood or other body fluids. And so at this point, I think the key message really is you got to be prepared for these viruses anywhere, anytime. I mean, let me give you a case in point. Right now, we think we have a big problem with measles in this country with, 2,500 cases. And we do for the year. But in Canada, a population of 40 million versus our 340 million, they have over 5,000 cases this year. Now, should we close the border to Canada for measles? In fact, and we know that there are people that are going back and forth. And again, the message is, what would you do to really stop it? You wouldn't. And so I think I'm more than willing to say at any time, if somehow we would reduce the likelihood of transmission of disease X by closing the border, go for it. Mm. Just show me an example where that really makes a difference.
So what about school closures?
Well, school closures is another one of the things that was a mistake. And what I mean by that is that we really misinterpreted the impact that COVID had on kids. In the first year of the pandemic, 199 kids died from COVID in this country. And when you looked at the overall number of deaths and you looked at the number of serious illnesses, it was substantially lower than we saw in adults, particularly older adults. However, what happened was with the additional new variants coming in, both Omicron and Delta, we saw those numbers go way up.
Yeah.
Over 1,500 kids died through the first 3 years of the pandemic.
Right.
87% of them died in the year two and three. And so what we did is we shut down schools in year one and took that more extreme measure. And then there were several publications that came out that said, see, this isn't so bad after all. Okay, kids can go to school. Problem was, it was much worse in year two and three. And not only was it worse in terms of what happened to kids, but there are several really good studies that were done, one in the Boston area, that showed that about 80% of the transmission of the virus into households was first introduced by school kids who picked it up at school.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anything, you could have argued that if there was a time when we might have tried to limit school efforts, it was in the second and third year, not the first year. And I think in the future, again, I would go with snow days. It's not yes or no. It's what's happening in your school right now. And if you're seeing activity pick up, 10 to 15% of the kids are out with COVID in a given day, then I think you want to say, maybe we need to close schools for a week or two. And and not long term, not the idea that they're done for the season, but rather to try to manage these surges in cases that were occurring.
So let's talk a little bit more about the vaccine. What should people understand about mRNA technology? What promise does it hold for future vaccines? I mean, if the big one comes, how quickly would you expect us to develop a vaccine at this point? Just give us the vaccine summary here.
Well, mRNA is a type of chemical that's in our body all the time. It never enters the actual nucleus of a cell. This is where the DNA is at. So it can't impact DNA. We are exposed constantly to RNA all the time, whether in food we eat, anything like that. And so this is not something that is brand new or foreign to our bodies. What we've done is figured out how to help lasso it into helping us make a vaccine. So what the mRNA does is it basically allows, by attaching to the cell, to introduce the spike protein, one of the parts of the virus, that then makes that cell make more spike protein. And it's a temporary, it's shut down within hours to days of when you first get injected. Mm. But what it does is it makes more of that antigen, the thing we want to get immune protection against, in your body. And it's actually a very clever, very efficient way to get much better protection. Again, let me just say this had been under research for more than 15 years before the pandemic. There are a number of infectious diseases for which mRNA vaccine technology is being explored. It has some real potential for a number of different cancers in terms of delivering to the body the kind of anti-cancer immunity that you want. And there is no truth at all that it hijacks your immune system or it hijacks the cells in your body. Simply doesn't happen. And so from our perspective, let me just always be clear. Vaccines are really good, but they're not great. What's great is vaccination. That's when you complete the cycle. And so if you don't have a vaccine, you can't vaccinate. And let me just give you an example of what's just recently happened regarding influenza vaccine preparedness in this current administration. We recognized early on that if we had an influenza pandemic as opposed to a COVID or a coronavirus pandemic, that our ability to make influenza vaccine on a global basis using these imbrated chicken eggs, remember, that's what we still grow the flu virus in chicken eggs like we did 50 to 60 years ago. Well, the bottom line is that we could, in the first year of a pandemic, make enough vaccine for less than a quarter of the world. That's our total capacity right now, and that's varying perfectly well. Well, if you had mRNA technology, you could make enough vaccine for the whole world in the first year, and it could be delivered quite well. In that situation, the difference between the first scenario and the second scenario is millions and millions and millions of lives lost. Well, so we initiated in this country a major initiative with the Biden administration to actually develop further work with mRNA technology for influenza vaccines. And that was really moving along, and this administration stopped all of it. And now we are no longer doing any work on mRNA technology for flu vaccine in the Department of Health and Human Services, which was the main area of research. This is really, really penny wise and pound foolish, because we are going to regret not having those vaccines when the next pandemic of influenza occurs.
But the reason is it's not penny wise. The reason is almost certainly not cost. It's probably based on this kind of anti-vax spookiness around the mRNA-based development of the vaccine.
Exactly. No, you're right. It's not about finance. It's about the issue of just against it. And again, you know, this has been an evolution in of itself. Remember, right after the whole Operation Warp Speed brought us the vaccine, you know, President Trump in his first administration was hailed as, you know, great leaders to have this actually arrive and to be available. It was truly a magnificent achievement. And so we watched it go from that status to the fact that over time, as some people looked at vaccine mandates and concerns about other things that they were indicating government was doing to them, this vaccine almost became emblematic of the resistance to what was happening with the pandemic. And then when the pandemic was over, it still remained. And so today, there is a tremendous amount of resistance to using this vaccine that is based largely on ideology and not based on anything to do with science. Now, Mr. Kennedy and others will put forward a pseudoscience that does not at all really exist in terms of any valid science. And so some people will say, well, no, the data says this. It's just not true. These vaccines do not cause the kinds of things they're suggesting, and they save lives.
Right. I mean, so to give some concession to the other side, there, I mean, as with any medical intervention, there's some rate of adverse reaction to vaccines. And in the case of the COVID vaccine, there's some signal around myocarditis, especially in young men and boys, and that, you know, the both the fact of that response and the perhaps the unwillingness to discuss it for fear of giving too many gifts to the conspiracists and the hysterics led to a fairly paranoid framing around the vaccine, that this vaccine is just killing millions. I mean, there are, you know, podcasters who have literally said that the vaccine has probably killed tens of millions of people at this point.
Right.
So
You know, all I can say is those are the same people that are unfortunately members of the Flat Earth Society.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you what really happened. Early on, when we first recommended this vaccine to be used, particularly in adolescent boys and young men, we actually did see these cases of myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart. They were across the board mild. They were hospitalized on average less than 2 days, and with no evidence of any kind of long-term damage to the heart. Well, guess what? We figured out that what it was is we had the vaccine spaced too closely together so that the second vaccine got a part of a first vaccine reaction that caused this to happen. When we spaced out these vaccines, and on top of that, now more and more young adolescent boys already had some antibody from previous exposure to the virus, we've not seen myocarditis in these boys for several years. But right. We keep going back to what happened initially, which was real.
Right.
And none of us tried to ignore that. And I think that's one of the problems is that, you know, one of the things that we have a real challenge with today with vaccines, there are clearly vaccine-associated injuries that occur. Make no mistake about it. And we take those very seriously and are constantly looking for them to understand what that might mean in terms of recommendation. But let me just give you the following scenario. You are driving home tonight, and on your way there, you're in an automobile accident. And unfortunately, your seatbelt won't unbuckle, and you're now caught in this burning vehicle, and you end up perishing as a result of the seatbelt jammed, and you can't get out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next day, we could argue that all seatbelts should be banned, but
yeah.
We know that the overall benefit of seatbelts and the number of people's lives that are saved far, far, far exceed what happened with you in that car, which is tragic. It was horrible. And we don't want to minimize that. But you have to look at what is the balance of what it does for society. And clearly, these vaccines save millions of lives.
Yeah. Let me give you my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we lost something like 1.2 million people so far from COVID in the U.S., and we believe that we probably lost 300,000 or so more than we should have based on a reluctance to take the vaccine. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, in the United States, that's exactly where it was. And, you know, we think that there were probably more deaths due to COVID than what you just reported, but not a lot more.
Okay.
But clearly, the overall impact over time, as we saw the pandemic unfold into the second and third year, we saw increasing numbers of deaths in red states.
Right. So the second point you made there was that before we had a vaccine, so no one could take a vaccine, we just were left to the state of nature. Republicans and Democrats were dying in the same numbers, but once we had a vaccine, which Democrats took at a much greater rate than Republicans did, we saw the curves depart from one another, and Republicans died in much greater numbers than Democrats.
That's true. With one addendum to that, is that even in the first 3 to 4 months after vaccine was available, we didn't see that differential in deaths, because at that point, it had not yet become the kind of issue that it did. And it was really in that next 6 months, by the summer of 2021, is when we really started to see the difference begin to really become noticeable.
Right, right. Huh. Well, there are a few podcasts that I think deserve some blame for that. People can read between the lines there. So actually, a final point on vaccines here. What is the vaccine adverse event reporting system, and how has it been misleading people?
Well, there are several different systems we have in this country that have very different purposes. And VAERS, the vaccine reporting system that you just talked about, is one that's meant to capture everything under the sun that could possibly be a negative health outcome in someone who's been vaccinated. And depending on what the outcome is how long after vaccination that you are required to report it. Healthcare providers are required to report any serious adverse event and can report anything, and any citizen can report. I mean, I've actually seen reports that said, my flu vaccine made me like the Hulk, okay? Mm-hmm. That was my adverse event.
Mm-hmm.
And what those data are for is to basically constantly scrub them to see, are there anything showing up here that might very well indicate some common trend? And so there's meant to be very, very far wide reaching. There is the data, vaccine data link system, which is actually goes into great detail on specific areas of vaccine safety. So if we had, for example, as we talked about a moment ago, the myocarditis, that got picked up in VAERS, but it immediately triggered the second system to be looking at this on a population basis. And so healthcare systems around the country are part of this large network, and we can go in quickly and say, guess what? We're seeing this kind of situation. And just to know that we picked up the myocarditis situation after 6 cases in young boys, mm-hmm. even though we ended up ultimately having 60. And so these two systems really are different. The problem with the VAERS system is everything gets thrown in.
So anyone can report, I can say.
Anybody can report on anything, and that's what many of the anti-vaccine people use. So when they say that 23% of the people who died, or 23 different individuals who died, that were reported to VAERS after having had a COVID shot, if you go look at all of those, none of those had anything to do with COVID. You know, and so, but that's what gets labeled then. And we have to keep fighting that over and over again to say, you got to look at the specific data. Was there any evidence that people died because of COVID? And we did have people who died from the original J&J vaccine early on. And we picked up that very quickly too. So these systems are actually very good.
The non-mRNA vaccine.
Right, exactly. They were not mRNA. Yes, exactly.
It strikes me there's a bit of a paradox or an unpleasant irony here that we have to confront, which is, so much of what we've been talking about is the confusion and the attendant pain of scientific uncertainty being expressed to a public that was increasingly combustible and hyperpartisan. All of that was the result of an erosion of trust in institutions, which kind of compounded upon itself. And it was just, at some point, both the media and government, you know, public health organizations were in free fall in terms of the esteem with which the general public, especially right of center, held them. But now the irony is that we have the capture of our public health institutions by, again, I think it's not too strong to say this, you know, maniacs and ideologues of various flavors. And it seems to me that it is rational at this point to worry that we can't trust the HHS or the CDC or the NSF or the NIH or any of these organizations that are living under the thumb of RFK Jr. and his acolytes. I mean, just to remind everyone of just how far afield from the scientific respectability RFK Jr. is. I mean, one, he's not a scientist. He's a lawyer and an activist who has been banging away in the anti-vax fever swamps for decades, and he is still not. I think he's somewhat cagey in how he talks about it now, but he has still not disavowed his heartfelt support for Andrew Wakefield, whose 1998 paper gave us the fear that the MMR vaccine is the source of all of our autism concerns. And that has been well understood to have been a scientific fraud for many years now. And Wakefield was discredited. He lost his medical license. All his 10 co-authors disavowed the paper. The paper was officially unpublished. He had been working for anti-vax attorneys. He had a conflict of interest because he had his own rival vaccine to the MMR vaccine. I mean, there was his whole situation was very, very messy ethically, and it's now well understood. And yet, RFK Jr. has described him as the most unfairly maligned person of his generation. And if we lived in a just society, we would be building statues to Andrew Wakefield. That's on RFK Jr.'s account. This is the guy who's running the HHS and who's deciding vaccine policy for the nation. So how are we to function now as consumers of information from the CDC and the FDA and the other relevant organizations, given that there has been a purge, the purge is continuing apace now, of scientifically sane people, and now there's just an endless series of loyalty tests, you know, throughout Trump's administration. But here, you know, even in science, selecting for people who will toe the party line.
Yeah, what you've identified is something that I could never have imagined seeing in my 50-year career in public health, and just to summarize it, we all have had our moments of disagreement with one or more issues that the CDC might have been involved with, but there was a tremendous respect and appreciation for the overall scientific expertise of that organization. So it pains me to no end to tell you, you cannot trust CDC today at all. Mm. You can't trust the FDA. Right now, at CDC, all of the senior level positions in the executive suite are political appointees with no scientific expertise. This would be like putting 12 individuals in charge of your aircraft carrier and all political appointees. Mm. I mean, this is tragic. And so we now in the science world, the medical public health world, recognize we can't trust them. And that is, in fact, why I was involved with starting a new effort called the Vaccine Integrity Project. I saw the night of the election when Mr. Trump won, I went pulled out the old 2025 guide that had been put forward as more or less the kind of document that would address how the new administration would unfold.
Project 2025?
Yeah. And if you look in there, you can see the public health side of the House was about to be destroyed. On top of that, Mr. Kennedy had become a very favorite of the president-elect, and it was clear that he was likely to be nominated for Secretary of HHS, which was unclear whether he'd be actually, would get the votes. I wrote a piece in the New York Times in mid-November saying, wake up, America. This guy's going to take your vaccines from you. You have to understand that. This is not about arguing on the fringes about how vaccines work or don't work. This is a guy who is bent on taking them all off. And he has an entire team, as you noted. It's not just him. If you look how he's basically put into HHS across the board, into the various organizations, these are people that are of like minds. Mm-hmm. And their intent is basically to destroy the public health system as we know it. And so some of us are trying to fight back. What we did with the Vaccine Integrity Project is we knew that this fall, the medical societies would be making their recommendations again for the fall seasonal vaccines, COVID, RSV, and influenza. Well, every year the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Innovation Practices at CDC, which is the outside group of experts that advises the CDC on vaccine recommendations, basically was dismissed. They were fired. Mm-hmm. They brought in individuals who were clearly anti-vaccine. They were not going to provide the heavy lift data review of all the vaccine material that normally would be turned over by ACIP to the medical society. We did that, and we worked very hard. And so the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Infectious Society of America, the OBGYNs, all based their recommendations on the data we turned over. So we are trying to fight back against this kind of anti-science and what I would have to say is almost unbelievable world. I mean, how can you have a hearing where you have an individual who is trapped in a sense to acknowledge that from his perspective, these COVID vaccines were dangerous, but then be asked 3 minutes later, but you think the president deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for these vaccines? Mm. And when she said yes, and he couldn't reconcile that when he was said, well, you just said they were poison. And he said, I didn't say that. I mean, in front of a public hearing on tape. So, I mean, when you have that kind of rationality, you have to basically realize it's not about a single policy or science or anything. It's a cause that is itself dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, RFK Jr. is a kind of Freudian case study. There's so much incoherence and such a lack of self-awareness around that it's, one reaches for psychological explanations. I mean, his work as an environmental attorney, an activist, it takes a completely different attitude toward established mm-hmm. scientific consensus. I mean, when talking about climate change, he's all about insisting that the scientific consensus be respected and adhered to, and anyone who would demur from what 97% of climate scientists believe, that person's just a monster and should be prosecuted, right? You know, whether it's the Koch brothers but get to vaccines and everything flips. Well, what do you make of the people who do have the appropriate scientific pedigrees and who have never been associated with the anti-vax community or any other crankery that I know of? I mean, they were selected for their slightly heterodox or in some cases fairly heterodox attitudes. during COVID, but I'm thinking of people like Jay Bhattacharya and Marty Makary and Vinay Prasad. I mean, these are doctors who are, you know, all have great CVs who have gone to work for Kennedy in one fashion or another. And they're collaborating in this project, but one, there's certainly been hopes that they're bringing some measure of, you know, scientific sanity to the operation. How are you perceiving their efforts?
Well, first of all, let me just say up front, again, you know, it is not personal, but I have to say the three individuals you just mentioned are people who I actually have very little respect for because of their publications and how they've done them.
Right.
And the positions they've taken. If you go back and look at each one of them, they have espoused information, in particularly with COVID, that's simply just not true.
Yeah.
And so from that perspective, they were brought in because they were going to be part of this activity to basically take vaccines away from the public. And let me be really clear. The other thing that's happening is if you're not going to be someone who's going to do whatever the secretary tells you to do, you're gone. Look at what happened to the most recent CDC director.
She lasted a month.
She lasted a month. And so I think one of the things that those three individuals also are well known for is they will acquiesce to the secretary in whatever he says. You know, they appeared with him at the White House last week on this issue with acetaminophen
and
autism.
That was amazing.
And they stood right by him.
Oh, my God.
You know, and then Marty got up and made comments that simply just were not true.
Mm.
And so, you know, I do not find that there is an automatic judgment that someone who I disagree with is a challenge in the sense of why do we disagree? But with these guys, it's not based on fact. It's not based on history. It's based on ideology. Mm. Science cannot be about ideology.
All right. So let's turn the corner and talk about the big one.
Uh-huh.
What keeps you up at night? What is the most plausible candidate for among the viruses for being the big one? And again, we're talking about something much worse than COVID, but spreads just as readily. Before you jump in, tell me why we're not worried about bacteria to the same degree as viruses.
Well, actually, I am worried about bacteria, but bacteria don't cause pandemics as such.
Right.
The modes of transmission and spread are different.
Yeah.
And even the bacteria that did have in the past association with what might call pandemics or black death, like your plague.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we can treat with antibiotics, and the transmission is much slower. It involves animals and as well as humans. So I think that we have to be mindful of bacteria. Where I worry about bacteria is antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
You know, we have watched a very rapid evolution of microbes becoming resistant to most of the drugs we have today. And that's not unexpected. The challenge is we don't have a pipeline of new and better drugs coming out for two reasons. One is all the easy targets are gone. And the microbes have figured out how to mutate around them to basically make it so that these antibiotics are not effective. The second thing is, who wants to get into antibiotic research and development today? Imagine I'm coming to you as a company that does research and development, makes antibiotics, and I'm telling you, spend a bunch of money, make this new really powerful antibiotic that we need, but don't use it then except for very, very limited
cases.
Take it
once in your life for 10 days.
Yeah,
$1 billion of upfront research.
Yeah. And so we're also seeing an absence of really R&D going into antimicrobial therapies because of this resistance / public policy approach. So I worry about bacteria. But clearly, the whole issue around virus with wings is really the most important ones, and that's influenza and coronaviruses.
Mm.
And historically, that's all we've seen that way. HIV/AIDS was, in fact, you could argue, a pandemic, but that unfolded over literally decades. And it wasn't one that you and I would necessarily be at risk if we didn't have a behavior or some kind of exposure that put us at risk. Whereas with a pandemic virus, everybody's at risk all the time, and that's the case.
So the worst case scenario, having read your book, correct me if I'm wrong, that the worst case scenario has these characteristics. We've already talked about it being, in principle, a respiratory virus that is aerosolized. So, you know, you can walk into a room and the person who was infected may even no longer be in that room, but the droplets are still suspended in air that they breathed out or talked out, and you can get infected just by living in the same space. We're talking about high lethality. We're also talking about people being infectious before they're symptomatic, correct?
Right.
Which is also something that's true of COVID, which we took a long time to realize.
And even some people who never developed serious illness, which we're still trying to understand why, you know, who actually transmit to others. And we can show John Doe was the source for these four people. John Doe at best had minor symptoms at all. The other four people got seriously ill and one of them died. We don't always understand that combination, but so that too adds to the issue of transmission concern.
What about incubation period? How long could there be this asymptomatic period where people might be infectious?
Well, you know, it was interesting because even with COVID, we saw that changing over time. Early on, from these limited exposure kinds of situations, we could clearly show where this person was exposed to someone at this time. We saw incubation periods of about 5 days. But as we got into the new variants, we got down to 2.5 to 3 days of incubation. And even with the incubation period of 2 to 3 days, they may have become infectious within a day or two. Mm. And so that has also been, I think, a lesson to us. Once you start to study this or follow this virus, keep studying it because it still may throw curveballs at you that change how you're thinking about your recommendations.
So in thinking about preparing for something like this, I mean, the one thing we have acknowledged that we need and don't have are masks that really work or work as well as they can work, at least as well as an N95, but which are much more comfortable to wear and perhaps are reusable in a way that N95s aren't,
yep.
So you're washable. And that really needs to be invented yesterday, and we need millions and millions of those stockpiled. So someone get on that ASAP. What else do we need to be prepared that we don't have?
You know, when I wrote this book, most people would have said, oh, there's bad news, Mike, again. In fact, this book is a love story from my perspective. I have 6 grandkids.
Mm.
And every day at my desk, I have this electronic picture frame that my kids gave me that every 30 seconds, a new shot goes by of my grandkids, one or more of them, okay?
Mm.
And, you know, my whole point in this book was, I do believe we can create the kind of vaccines for flu and for coronaviruses that can have broad, broad protection against something that has yet emerged.
Right.
You know, one that hasn't.
So like a universal coronavirus vaccine.
Exactly. Yeah. And our center actually works a lot on this. We actually have what we call the roadmaps for keeping track of where this research is at. But we've not made a commitment to dealing with this. And as we discussed earlier, think about this. More people have died this century in this country from a microbe than have died from all the wars combined.
Mm-hmm.
And why are we not putting that kind of support into the defense against microbes as we do against the defense against other people? And to me, you know, I don't know how much we need to spend to defend ourselves against other people. I'm not an expert, but I can say right now, there has been no commitment to finding the kind of vaccines that we could, that would basically take this off the table.
Mm.
That's where my optimism comes in, because I hope we can. And someday, maybe someone will wake up and say, you know what? This is an insurance policy. We're not going to go buy the fire truck the moment we need it, okay? We're going to buy it a little ahead of time. And what if we could get that? And again, let me just point out, I mentioned this earlier too, 285 kids died from flu this past year. 285.
Mm.
Half of them had no risk factors for serious illness. You know what? If we had a good, effective vaccine that had durable protection, I could see kids being vaccinated in infancy and having protection for some years to come. So that's, for me, a high, high priority, is really supporting this kind of vaccine work that could take both of those viruses off the table as global challenges.
Why do some viruses mutate so much more quickly than others? I mean, so you get vaccinated for measles, you basically have immunity for life. You get vaccinated for flu, you get immunity for like 5 minutes. What's the difference?
Well, it's all about how they basically generate themselves. How do they actually make themselves capable of surviving? When they get inside a cell, how do they actually get out of the cell? It has a whole number of issues. Where do they multiply? Do they multiply in your blood or do they multiply in your lungs? And each one is different that way, but you're exactly right. You know, that's one of the beauties of a virus like measles, is if you can be protected against it at any point in your life, you're likely protected for the rest of your life. And where on the other hand, you have the flu and COVID viruses that basically mean you have to get vaccinated with boosters at least once a year because the protection wanes. It doesn't spill over into new emerging strains. Mm. And each one of those has to do with just the whole genetics and how they multiply and what that means.
Okay, so we need a better mask. We need universal vaccines. What about surveillance? Is there any role for technological breakthroughs there that would matter?
Absolutely. You know, in this country, we track so many things today, you know, that you have to acknowledge your personal information is being monitored by somebody all the time. Yet we hear over and over again the public saying, if we had a medical ID number, each one of us, where our records could basically be linked up no matter where we're at, whether I'm in Minneapolis or I'm in Houston, I'm in Boston, it's like my Social Security number. You got me, okay? If we could do that and track that, we could actually come up with much, much better timely information on what was happening with infectious diseases. But again, there's been a lack of information or a lack of willingness to look at that kind of information sharing, and I think is a real challenge. So I do think from an electronic medical record, we are in a much better position today to have much better surveillance of what goes on out there. And again, that's another piece that I would add. And we talk about that in the book, how we can improve on that for a much more timely follow-up.
Hmm. It seems that COVID was in some ways the worst case scenario in terms of undermining our capacity for preparedness for the thing you're really worried about, because it was not lethal enough. It was just, yep. It was benign enough so that there could be real differences of opinion about whether to take it seriously, and therefore every response to it seemed like, totalitarian overreach if you didn't think the virus was a thing. If you thought it was just a cold or just a flu, and every, you know, shrill source of disagreement on that topic was then perceived by you as a kind of Orwellian sign of something truly awful that was coming, right? This was the plandemic, yeah. Or this was, you know, the Davos, you know, lizard people deciding to take over the world and use this as a pretext. And it seems to me that none of that would have been possible had just the level of death been, you know, up to the point where it would have been undeniable. And we just have to agree, okay, this is, or just even if just the dynamics of lethality were flipped so that if this was killing children preferentially rather than old people, right, you wouldn't have the argument that, okay, like, listen, old people are old people for a reason. You know, they're close to death. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's a tragedy when you die when you're 80, but it's not it's not the same sort of tragedy when you're 8 as it is when you're 8. So had this been killing kids, I just think the denialism that grew up around the fact that we were in the midst of a pandemic would have been very hard to have gotten any energy behind. But it seems to me now that we really are, when I think of how fractured our society is on this topic, there's going to be a very unpleasant learning curve in the face of the next pandemic, no matter how bad it is, because it's going to be, there's so many people who are just locked and loaded to think of anything on this front in terms of conspiracy theories and the government's desire to capture, you know, everything and deprive you of your freedoms. And, you know, you're going to give me a number, a health tracking number and an app I need to have on my phone. That is just, you know, that's just CCP level infringements of my liberty, and I'm not going to stand for it.
You know, I so appreciate your critical thinking on this, because far too many people are afraid to think like this because they'll be quoted as saying, it didn't kill nearly enough. But you and I both know what we meant by that.
Yes.
In fact, you were right on the mark. It wasn't that catastrophic to cause people to say, whoa, but it was catastrophic enough by both time and the number of people that did die to have a true impact on us, our economy, all of that. And so I think you're exactly right. And, you know, I'm reminded of this because throughout my career, you know, I put these potential predictions out there. and have been heavily panned. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was just interesting because I was just having this discussion this past week with Chuck Todd, and I was on Meet the Press back just before the Omicron virus began to circulate. And I said, I thought the darkest days of the pandemic were still ahead of us. And Nate Silver came after me with knives, you know, for being so negative and and whatever. And I didn't really. And 55% of the deaths occurred after the date of that particular interview in the pandemic. And it was not that I was trying to say that I wanted to see more bad cases or that people were going to need to die, but it was an understanding of what does this mean? What is it? And I think you said it very, very well about what will the public respond to? Is it going to take a whole nother level of severity before people say, whoa? You know, so I thank you for framing that because I think that we need to have more discussion about that very point.
Do you think it's conceivable that we could win the argument in advance and persuade people that this is, there's a categorically different threat out there that has some of the same dynamics? I mean, we're talking about respiratory spread.
Yeah.
We're talking about the ineffectuality of measures like closing borders, et cetera. I mean, but so it's familiar in the sense that it echoes COVID, but there's just a something changes fundamentally when you up the lethality by a factor of 10 or more.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out how to price that in advance and be motivated by it. And also just, and to be motivated by the certainty that it really, I mean, we're leaving aside the prospect of, you know, synthetic biology being the source of this and, you know, bioterrorism, you know, a pandemic that is engineered and weaponized for, you know, obviously sinister reasons. Leave that aside. Just Mother Nature alone, left to her own devices, is going to cough something like this up eventually. And this is not, we don't have to wait around for 100,000 years like like the next asteroid impact, probabilistically. Do you think it's possible to say this clearly enough and often enough such that we actually just culturally recover from what we did and didn't do during COVID and approach this risk with something like, you know, rationality and clarity and not and nonpartisan pragmatism?
You know, I don't know, but I think that the point that you're making is one that we have to continue to put forward. You know, you mentioned earlier about what if this was killing a lot of kids? I've seen time and time again where the risk assessment does change in a community as opposed to a group of older individuals in a nursing home dying of Legionnaire's disease. If a group of kids are dying from meningitis in their school, even though the death numbers may be the same, totally different response in terms of how people perceive the risk. And I think that one of the things we have not done a good enough job of in public health is helping to understand how do people perceive risk? What are the things that make them actually change what they're thinking or what they're doing based on that risk perception? And I think we have a lot more work to do in that area. And it's one, though, that is really important, and we shouldn't be afraid of taking it on.
Well, Michael, thank you for the education here, and thank you for the work you've been doing for now for many, many years, but in my hearing, you know, several years. And it's you've been one of the voices of sanity for...
Well, you know, thank you. You know, I know I don't want it to come across as somehow, thank you to you. You know, you've had a voice that's not been afraid to take on the tough issues. And that's what we need more of right now. We just need to have that done in a non-partisan way. Just these are the facts. These are what we know. So thank you for what you do and how you do it.
Again, the book is The Big One, How We Must Prepare for Future Deadly Pandemics. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.